Indie Week is brought to you as a service for our blind and print-impaired listening audience from the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Federson with the May the 1st issue of Indie Week. And it's IndieWeek.com if you want to pursue some of these articles on your own off the internet, IndieWeek.com. And we have a thick issue, as usual, and including many, many articles that I haven't had a chance to read from previous issues. I'll do my best. And doing my best means I better stop the intro and start reading stories. Here I go. Wake County representatives urge congressional Republicans not to cut food assistance for 500,000 North Carolina children. In North Carolina, more than 1 in 5 children rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, to get them healthy, nutritious foods they need to carry them through each day. That's over 500,000 children across the state, including tens of thousands in Wake County. Now that assistance is under threat, congressional Republicans and the Trump administration are looking to cut more than $1.5 trillion from federal health, education, and nutrition programs, including, potentially, $230 billion or more from the House Agriculture Committee, which is responsible for administering SNAP over the next decade. Sarah Crawford, who represents Wake County in the North Carolina House of Representatives, said on a call with reporters today, "This is not just a line item in the budget. It's a direct threat to health, stability, and dignity of families across our state." Joining Crawford on the call was Wake Representative Julie Von Heifen, who said 34,800 children in her state house district would lose food assistance under these proposed cuts outlined in Congressional Republicans' budget resolution that passed the U.S. House in February. Van Heffin, a substitute teacher in Wake County Public Schools, emphasized the connection between hunger and poor academic outcomes, saying, "I know that kids need a full stomach in order to be able to concentrate, interact, and have a stable emotional mindset to tackle the day. We all need that, whether we're kids or adults." Hiba Atwa, Director of Legislative Advocacy and Campaigns at the nonprofit, nonpartisan NC Budget and Tax Center, said the threats to food assistance are part of a larger push to cut government spending in order to finance tax cuts that will overwhelmingly benefit wealthy citizens. Atwa emphasized that it's not clear yet what exactly the cuts to food assistance would look like, but could include lawmakers making the cuts outright, tightening up work requirements in order to receive benefits, or shifting the cost of running SNAP onto the states. She added, "This is absolutely without precedent, asking a state to help fund a federal program like SNAP." She added, "The most recent estimates suggest North Carolina could be asked to cover up to $740 million each year in SNAP benefits if these cuts are fully implemented." Quote, "That's about the salaries of about 13,000 teachers per year. North Carolina can't afford to subsidize federal tax cuts for the wealthy. Our state is already facing our own revenue shortfalls because of years of state lawmakers choosing to eliminate income taxes for corporations and cutting taxes that disproportionately benefit the wealthy rather than focus on the needs of people in our state. The cuts," Crawford noted, "won't just impact children and working families." She said, "We have to talk about this proposal as not just failure, but economic malpractice. SNAP dollars don't get hoarded. They are spent immediately in corner stores, supermarkets, farmers markets. They support grocers, farm workers, delivery drivers. Cutting SNAP," she added, "would cause lasting harm to North Carolina families who are already struggling." Quote, food assistance is one of the most effective tools we have to fight hunger, reduce poverty, and support children's development. It's not a handout. It's a smart investment in public health and economic strength. Crawford and Von Heffen said they are lobbying Wake County's congressional delegation, including Republican Congressman Brad Knott, with whom they're planning to meet next week, to oppose the cuts to SNAP. Von Heffen says, no one has made life better by taking away food from children who need it. The idea that our society should care for its children, all of its children, regardless of their parents' wealth or poverty, is not novel and should not be controversial. Next, Little Makers Academy in Raleigh braces for cuts to early childhood education funding. That child care center already lost funding for English language tutoring for its staff. Its director worries that cuts to food assistance and child care vouchers could come next. This is Little Makers, a child care center in Raleigh that primarily serves low-income families, is already beginning to feel the impact of federal funding cuts. Its teachers lost access to a federally funded English language tutoring program in March, and now ongoing funding for food assistance and child care vouchers is up in the air. Little Makers director Chris Romali says, people need to understand that child care is not a luxury, it is an infrastructure. It's a whole domino effect, he says. If people don't have a place to take their kids, they can't go to work. Little Makers emanates cheeriness before you've even stepped inside. Plastic sunflowers, rainbow-colored pinwheels flank the doorway. A bright blue awning offers shade, and a yard sign announces in several languages, you are our neighbors. The interior is equally charming, with little kids' artwork covering practically every vertical surface. Inside one classroom, the lead teacher, Mariela, and her assistant, Lubna, are taking care of the one and under set, who are beginning to scoot, crawl, and clap. Down the hall, Pat, who's been working in child care for more than 40 years, is teaching the pre-kindergarten class to read and write their ABCs. Outside, in a fenced-off play area, the lead teacher, Kayla, and her assistant, Mia, are overseeing a group of curious 1- and 2-year-olds as they explore the play equipment and the fascinating array of twigs and leaves on the ground. Little Makers employs 9 full-time teachers, 5 substitutes, and 5 administrators to take care of between 70 and 80 kids aged 5 and under. Many of the kids are enrolled full-time. The child care center is like their second home. They eat breakfast, lunch, and a snack here every weekday. They are bonded with the teachers and their classmates. 3/4 of them attend at a free or reduced rate thanks to a state and federally funded child care voucher program. Little Makers goes out of its way to hire a diverse, multilingual staff that reflects the community it serves, Romali explains. Some of the teachers were learning English through a tutoring program funded by a federal grant for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, but that grant was recently canceled and the tutor was laid off. Romali adds, we think it's very important for children to get diversity at school. She adds the school employs teachers from countries across the world, including Afghanistan, Morocco, Peru, the Congo, Honduras, and El Salvador. Some of the staff who lost access to that tutoring program have found alternatives. Sarah, the facility care specialist at Little Makers, whose first language is Spanish, just started taking online English classes at Wake Tech. But she had to reduce her work hours from full to part-time to accommodate that change. Nilab, a substitute teacher whose first language is Dari, hasn't found an alternative to the English tutoring program that worked for her. Losing access to that program will directly impact teachers' professional development. In order for them to get promotions and raises, they need to complete trainings and certifications that North Carolina offers only in English. Rimeli said, "We have teacher assistants that have been with us a long time. They show great potential. We'd love to make them lead teachers, but on paper, we can't." The Trump administration's immigration policies worry Rimeli too, since many of Little Maker's staff and students are immigrants. She says, "I go to bed every night scared. If ICE were to come, what would we do?" Little Makers also receives about $4,000 a month through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Child and Adult Care Food Program, CACFP, to pay for food. That program hasn't been impacted by federal cuts so far, but in March, the USDA eliminated a different $1 billion program that helped schools and child care centers pay for food. Rimeli said, "Lots of times the only food a child gets in a day is at our center. If Little Makers loses funding to purchase food, rates of hungry families will go up." The future of the child care vouchers they rely on to serve low-income families is also tenuous. There's a wait list for the vouchers in Wake County right now, says Rimeli, and North Carolina is not issuing any new ones. She said, "When it's time to enroll new students, it's going to be a little difficult for the low-income families because they're not going to be able to get a voucher if they don't already have one." The sticker prices at Little Makers range from $847 to $1,300 per child per month, depending on the child's age. That's lower than most other options in Raleigh, according to Rimeli, but it's still inaccessible for low-income families without help from the voucher program. Kayla, one of the lead teachers, said, "A lot of people think kids going to daycare is a privilege. I think every child deserves to go to school no matter what age, and they should be treated fairly and equally." Jamaica Johnson, assistant director there at Little Makers, quote, "We as educators can be underrated, especially when we're trying to diversify the learning perspective for the children. At the end of the day, when things that are being offered are then being taken away, everybody loses." Rimeli has been vocal about the importance of early childhood care as potential cuts loom. On May the 12th, she and her staff will participate in the nationwide Day Without Child Care. Instead of opening Little Makers, they'll go to the state legislature to speak with lawmakers about the need for better child care funding. Earlier this month, Rimeli addressed the Raleigh City Council during a public comment session to raise awareness. And she said, "Child care is the backbone of our economy and community, but it's cracking under pressure." Next, Duke University aims to cut 10% of their budget in response to federal funding threats. They aim to reduce these costs by $350 million, or about 10% of its expenses, due to these threatened cuts under President Donald Trump. Duke officials said at the meeting the school will initiate a voluntary separation program for certain employees beginning next week. Daniel Ennis, university's executive vice president, said the goal is not to offer a broad-based retirement incentive, but rather to target positions that leaders expect to eliminate for at least the next 3 years. Ennis said the university plans to discuss voluntary separation with hundreds of employees by May the 21st. The results of that program will be known by mid-July, after which the university puts into layoffs. That number would depend on how many people take voluntary separation. He said, "It's hard to get to that $350 million target without having significant impact on our employees." Officials said the target cost reduction amount was based on projections that the federal funding cuts and policy changes could result in losses as much as $500 million to $750 million. It will be met via a bottom-up process in which various schools and other units are tasked with finding savings, with the goal of reaching that $350 million mark over the next 3 to 5 years. The university had already said it would reduce spending and implement cost-cutting measures in response to federal funding cuts. Duke President Vincent Price announced in March that he had tasked senior administrators from the university and health system to develop a strategic realignment and cost reduction planning process. Shortly after that message, Duke's student newspaper, The Chronicle, reported that three senior administrators sent an email to faculty and staff outlining a hiring freeze and additional measures, including the suspension of capital spending, a pause on mid-year salary adjustments, and a review of hiring practices. The administrators also said they would assess off-campus real estate, on-campus space consolidation, and employee benefit programs. Officials have previously said the university planned to have an update on their progress by May for the Board of Trustees, and decisions on staff reductions would be finalized by the end of the summer. Between the university and its health system, Duke is the second largest private employer in the state and the largest in Durham County. In total, they have more than 44,500 full-time and part-time employees in the state, and it paid $4 billion in salaries and wages in 2024. Ennis told faculty and staff at the meeting, "The potential threats in federal funding touch every corner of this institution. There's no part of our mission, there's no part of our enterprise that would not be impacted." Unlike some of its peers, Duke has not been singled out for funding cuts from the Trump administration. Other elite private schools like Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Pennsylvania have seen big swaths of research grants and federal funding pulled in response to Trump administration demands. Instead, the administration's proposed cap on indirect costs tied to research funding, portions of federal grants used to pay for salaries, equipment, and supplies, poses a threat to Duke's financial stability. While the floated cap on National Institutes of Health grants has been halted by a federal judge for now, Duke officials have said some anticipated funding has not come through, and other policy changes proposed by the administration could affect the school's finances. According to a transcript obtained by the Assembly, that is one of IndyWeek's journal partners, Price said during a webinar for faculty and staff in April that Duke has been most affected so far by changes to research grants, including the cancellation of some in-progress grants, as well as significant delays in the typical process used for awarding and processing grants. Jennifer Lodge, the University Vice President of Research and Innovation, said later in that meeting that the university had received about 50% of what it would have expected to earn from grants in a typical year. "If indirect cost cuts come to fruition," said Price, "Duke would face a $200 million shortfall. Combined with other potential policy changes, like Trump's proposal to hike the tax rate on university endowments from 1.4% to as high as 21%, Price said losses could add up to around $500 million per year. Price and other administrators also expressed concerns about changes that could hurt the university's health system, pointing to proposed cuts to Medicaid floated by House Republicans in recent weeks. Alec Gallimore, Duke Provost, quote, "Every school and unit in Duke is going to be impacted by this environment." Across the country, more than a dozen public and private universities have implemented hiring freeze and other cost-cutting measures, though few institutions have responded with layoffs. Johns Hopkins University laid off more than 2,200 workers following the Trump administration's cuts to USAID. Duke officials have made it clear that cuts are inevitable in the current environment. Price, in his annual address to faculty in late March, quote, "We will need to make some difficult trade-offs If we're smart and serious about pruning and perhaps thinning now as needed, we can position ourselves well for a vigorous response when conditions more conducive to growth return. Well, to Raleigh and St. Augustine's University. Their board chair says that the school misused federal grants and submitted inaccurate financial data. As St. Aug's faces down existential threats in the form of lawsuits, property liens, crippling debt, a state investigation, and potential accreditation loss, Board Chair Brian Boulware is blaming the Raleigh HBCU's financial predicament on, quote, administrative negligence, and denying that the board played a role. He released a statement on Thursday in response to months of criticism of his and the board's leadership from alumni, former employees, former trustees, higher education experts, and outside observers, many of whom have publicly asked him to resign. In that statement, Boulware alleges that St. Aug's administration mismanaged the school's finances for more than a decade, unbeknownst to the Board of Trustees. In the time period Boulware chronicles in his statement, SAU's administration has changed frequently. The school has had several different presidents and significant administrative turnover since 2012. Some of Boulware's claims have been documented previously. The university did not complete financial audits from 2020 to 2024 or pay payroll taxes to the IRS from 2020 to 2023. But most of the claims are new. Taken together, they paint a grim picture of the extent of SAU's financial and regulatory troubles and raise even more questions about whether the board is fulfilling its role at the university. According to Boulware, university leaders took out a $6 million loan against the endowment in 2012, which accrued interest and fees and ultimately cost SAU $11 million. In 2016, he writes, the university misused or fraudulently drew down 90% of the federal grants it received that year, quote, severely jeopardizing our credibility with government partners. He alleges that in 2018, administrative staff and a, quote, vendor falsified financial records they presented to the Southern Association of College and Schools Commission on Colleges. That's the accrediting body for this university. He further alleges university staff wired, quote, a significant portion of the federal COVID-19 relief funds they received to, quote, unknown sources. He writes that SAU has since referred this case to the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. From 21 to 23, he says, administrators permitted students to graduate despite carrying unpaid tuition balances exceeding $30,000 in violation of federal aid regulations. He alleges that university officials knew about these unpaid payroll taxes and met with the IRS but did not inform the Board of Trustees, who only learned about the problem until after former university professor Christine McPhail was terminated. Finally, Boulware claims the administration, quote, willingly misled the board by intentionally withholding information and submitting false financial reports, resulting in the non-compliance with several federal agencies. Indy Week and the Assembly previously reported that in 2023, the accreditors convened a special committee to examine the finances and evaluate St. Aug's compliance with these requirements, including board governance standards. In keeping with Boulware's admission that he and his fellow trustees were ignorant to the financial circumstances between 2012 to 2023, the committee found the board, quote, was not able to demonstrate, nor able to communicate detailed processes and procedures for fiduciary oversight and fiscal management of the institution. it was not evidence that the board has a clear understanding of its role in the management process, nor does it have a clear understanding or appreciation of the severity of the current fiscal issues, the committee wrote. While Boulware asserts that administrative staff at SAU engaged in misconduct without the board's knowledge, former staff members have made similar accusations against him and the board. Whistleblowers have alleged that Boulware was closely involved in the university's day-to-day operations and accused him of overreach. In 2020, the then Vice President of University Advancement and External Affairs, Deborah Clark Jones, submitted an internal complaint describing how Boulware, James Perry, the board chairman at the time, and Maria Lumpkin, the interim president at the time, suggested they falsify board meeting minutes to retroactively indicate that a contract was approved. Another former administrator, Ronald Brown, complained internally in 2020 that the Board of Trustees in general, and Boulware in particular, were overly involved in the university's daily operations, particularly hiring, firing, and contracting decisions, to the point where Brown decided to resign due to, quote, constant overreach, interference, and intrusion. Boulware has previously denied these allegations, and in his newest statement he once again defended himself and reiterated his dedication to SAUs. Quote, it is critical to note I did not join the Board of Trustees until 2019 and was elected chairman in 2024 after most of these failures had already occurred. Furthermore, over 70% of the current board members have only served within the last 18 months. We were not present when the damage was done, but we have accepted the responsibility of leading the recovery. The statement lists several reforms the current board has made to right past wrongs, including completing overdue audits, paying overdue salaries and benefits to faculty staff. 2 weeks ago, the journalist and commentator Roland Martin held a live-streamed town hall in Raleigh near SAU's campus where he interviewed several alumni and former staff about the school's downward spiral and publicly called on Boulware to resign from the Board of Trustees. Martin invited Boulware and President Marcus Burgess to participate, but they declined. During that town hall and in a subsequent YouTube video posted yesterday, which have a cumulative 30,000 views, Martin slams Boulware for denying culpability. Quote, your own letter shows that is an absolute lie, he says in this video. You were present for 5 years. Boulware insinuated on Thursday's statement that Martin's accusations amount to defamation. He writes, social media posts, public rants, and unfounded accusations have created confusion, harmed donor confidence, jeopardized funding opportunities. Our legal team has thoroughly documented every defamatory claim and is prepared to respond appropriately and in the proper venue. As the school year draws to a close, St. Augustine's University is waiting a decision from a panel of accreditors and arbitrators who will decide if the school loses accreditation permanently. If that were to happen, SAU would lose federal funding and enrollment would likely plummet. Boulware previously told Indy and the Assembly he will not yield to calls for his resignation during this critical time for the school's survival. And this article was written in April the 25th of this year. Next, affordable housing. This is articles about affordable housing, particularly in the Triangle area and state and nationwide, occur with frequency. And here's just another one of them. On Thursday night, the Cary Town Council unanimously approved a rezoning application from Greenwood Forest Baptist Church. that paves the way for it to build 62 affordable housing units on the church's property. The Carr Center, as the building will be called, is a partnership between church, the housing nonprofit, The Carrying Place, and the nonprofit housing developer, DHIC. The ground floor will house the Greenwood Forest Children's Center for Early Childhood Education, offices for The Carrying Place, and an offshoot of the local YMCA. The upper floors will be affordable apartments for households, making 30-60% of area median income when rented, or up to 80% of AMI when purchased. 11 units will be reserved as transitional housing for families experiencing homelessness. The church will demolish an underused part of its sanctuary to make room for the new building. The associate pastor at Greenwood Forest Baptist, Wesley Spears Newsom, says, "We wanted to figure out how that could become a community asset rather than something that was sitting empty. We talked to dozens of partners around Wake County, around the state, some even around the country, and asked, what should we do? Everybody that we talked to, regardless of their focus, said, if you have land, you need to build housing." Nothing quite like the Carr Center currently exists in Cary or Wake County. The church drew inspiration from the Southeast Raleigh Beacon affordable housing community. That's a mixed-use development that houses an elementary school, Southeast Raleigh YMCA, and a self-help credit union branch, in addition to housing and churches in Virginia, Texas, and California that have built housing on their land. Spears Newsom says, "I would characterize what we're doing as part of a movement that's arisen in the past several years of, yes, in God's backyard, kind of a response to the not in my backyard ideology. We believe that when churches have something that everyone else needs, it needs to be shared. And right now, that is land." Wake County has an affordable housing deficit of 65,000 units as of 2023. A recent report projects the county will need to add more than 100,000 affordable and market-rate homes by 2029 to meet demand. And Spears Newsom says, "We would encourage every congregation of whatever denomination or religious tradition to consider, if they have land, could they build housing?" On Thursday, Cary's Town Council applauded Greenwood Forest Baptist for its visionary slam-dunk proposal. After years of discussing and planning, it took the council members about 15 minutes to unanimously approve the rezoning request. That was a refreshing pivot after nearly 3 hours of public comments from Cary residents voicing overwhelming opposition to two other proposed developments. That would be Waverly Place and Regency Multifamily. Each would add hundreds of apartments to the town's housing stock. Residents complained the added density would harm their quality of life, hurt their property values, and make them feel unsafe in their neighborhoods. Opposition to the Regency Multifamily proposal, which would rezone a tract of land near Cocobooth Amphitheater from office to multifamily and add 245 apartments, was especially virulent. The developer included a condition that 5% of the units be priced for people earning 80% of Cary area median income, which is about $100,000, according to Mayor Harold Weinbrecht. Thursday's public hearing on the proposal was part of a multi-step rezoning process, and the council won't vote on it for several months. One neighbor said she'd be afraid of someone approaching or assaulting her during her evening walks if those affordable units get built. Another said he doesn't want Cary to turn into Jersey City or East Los Angeles. The council members largely validated residents' concerns about growth, albeit without such an overt fear factor. Some suggested the Cocoa Booth area needs food and drink options more than new housing. Others took issues with the limited affordability conditions. By the end of their discussion, most of the members seemed prepared to nix the Regency proposal and, quote, wait for something that really serves this community. Councilmember Carissa Cohn Johnson said in response to neighbors' concerns about traffic and overcrowding, we can't just plop apartments anywhere. I don't feel like this is the right spot. This article ends saying it was a far cry from the discussions of a moral imperative to provide housing that accompanied that Carr Center proposal. All right, a longer article now. This was written by Jane Porter back in mid-April about Graveside Do-It-Yourself, or DIY, the skaters of Graveside. Before February, when the excavators came, Raleigh was home to a vibrant skate park. Known as Graveside DIY, the park fostered a diverse community of skateboarders who raised thousands of dollars to pay for ramps they built themselves. Local skaters likened that park, a concrete and asphalt expanse, surrounded by evergreen trees and tucked along a side street just south of Tryon Road, to a community garden, a second home, a place to freely fail. At Graveside, there was stacking and mortaring, carpentry and pouring, heel flipping and front side grinding. There was hanging, grilling, and general carousing. Aaron Collins, who runs the Graveside Instagram account and helped build many of its ramps, says, just loud music, people tailgating every single day, cooking food every day. We'd go out there in the morning, stay all day long. We'd have bands play out there, stay the night there. A city skate park is more for like a two-hour visit, but a place like this, you spend your life there. On New Year's Eve, that Southwest Raleigh property, just over 13 acres in total, located on Mid Pines Road, changed hands. North Carolina-based Blue Heel Development bought the parcel from the Islamic Association of Raleigh for $1.25 million. In the third fastest-growing housing market in the nation, has plans for a new residential community. Eventually, more than a dozen townhomes will line the site of the space that's now rubble, part of a 57-unit subdivision. With its remote-feeling, picturesque situation on private property, Graveside was too good to last. The skaters knew, but they say you can't kill an idea. They're looking for a new DIY space to recapture some of the magic. They've taken a request to the Raleigh City Council to help them find underutilized public land. A cast-off private lot would work, too, as long as they could make it theirs. They know how to build it out and can get their own insurance. I'm just asking for permission, says Collins. Like a slab of concrete, like even a corner of the woods somewhere, we can make that work. All we want is permission. On a warm, windy afternoon at the end of March, the air yellow with pollen, the former Graveside site is serene. A bent metal patio heater, the kind you see outside of bars, stands at one end of the gravel open field. A pile of stacked, felled pine trees lies at the other. While trespassing, writes Jane Porter, I have the feeling of being the only person around for miles. Though single-family homes are in my sight line, and I hear traffic noise drifting up from Tryon Road over the sound of chirping birds. Facing away from the street to the left of what was once the skate park, Myrie Creek, filled with tadpoles, traverses a sliver of forest. To the right, up a little hill, an old family cemetery, sunken into a forested ridge, borders a sprawling green agricultural field that belongs to NC State University. The cemetery belongs to Raleigh LaRoche III, according to property records, but it has long been a resting place for members of John Winters' family. LaRoche is a descendant of Winters, a Raleigh businessman, a developer, civil rights leader, Raleigh's first black city council member, and one of North Carolina's first black state senators. Many of the graves are marked only with small signs or metal plaques, but a few larger stones bear names. Annie U. Kendrick, 1890-1963, Alfonso Rogers, 1884-1921, and Richard, who died at age 6 on Christmas Day, 1922. Graveside started as a closely guarded secret back in 2016, Collins told me on a phone call a few weeks earlier. A group of older skaters started building stuff there, he says, and if they caught you there, they'd make you leave. They wouldn't let you film. The Islamic Association of Raleigh was holding the land for eventual building or long-term investment. A spokesperson told Indian likely wasn't aware of the skaters' use of the property till it was ready to sell. Occasionally, a cop would come by and ask some skaters to leave, said Collins, but there was no serious enforcement. Eventually, word got out. The site became a free-for-all during the pandemic years and just kind of got overrun with, like, the second generation, which is us, said Collins, the younger guys, and then we just, like, full-on went crazy and built a skate park there. GoFundMes had historically paid for graveside projects, but at some point started seeing diminishing returns. Collins suggests I call his friend, Jonathan Robbins, a.k.a. J-Rob, who was in charge of raising the money to pay for all the materials the architects needed to build. Collins wrote in a text message, "Think of him, J-Rob, as a failed accountant. He's not very smart, but he certainly can tell a great story." When we speak, it's clear that J-Rob is neither failed nor lacking in smarts. In 2022, he started selling graveside-branded merchandise, T-shirts, hoodies, skateboards, and raised nearly $18,000. And he says it was like 6 or 7 graphics. So all the different homies that were, like, involved with the space did a graphic for it, and so, like, all the money we raised on that merch went to the spot. Everyone gave a little, he says, and they used the money to build the entire park and maintain it. They bought cinder blocks, mortar, concrete, 2x4s, plywood, plus the tools they needed to build ramps, drill bits, shovels, screws, brooms, a concrete mixer, paint, epoxy, lacquer, and trash bags to maintain the concrete coping, which breaks down over time. J-Rob wrote in an email, "Concrete coping offers a better grind, so we kept up the maintenance rather than, say, steel coping." He sent me a spreadsheet that showed the costs broken down for Graveside's dozen or so obstacles. I guess it shows we went the extra mile to create a better park. One of the products of the skaters' builds was the punk wall, a ramp over 6 feet tall that was built in 22. J-Rob estimates it to have cost $900 to $1,200. Another, built in 23, was the rainbow coping quarter pipe. It cost around $500. Also in 23, the skaters built the loop, one of Graveside's most memorable projects, out of concrete, held in place with wood to dry. At a cost of just over $1,000, it was one of the only loops at a DIY skate park like in the Southeast, and initially the skaters weren't even sure if it would be skatable, but it was. It's a Saturday afternoon in mid-March, and some of the Graveside crew are pouring concrete at the Cunyon Family State Park. That's a $300,000 temporary space located along Capitol Boulevard on the edge of downtown, familiarly known as Skate Raleigh. Against a backdrop of reggae music and harsh sunlight, skaters are building a small ramp. First, you stack a wall with cinder blocks and mortar, J-Rob had explained. Then you create a form from wood and you pour in concrete. I asked some of the crew about their memories from Graveside, how it differed from city-sanctioned skate park like this one. Nate Mott answered, "It's just a lot more involved. It's like if you were to make yourself and your friends dinner or something, it's more meaningful than like going out somewhere. Like, you build it. You make the dinner all together." Mott and Collins reminisce about the first annual shit-throwing competition with games such as Bucket in a Tree. literally, throw a bucket in a tree, and when it lands, throw things to knock it down again. And shoes on a light pole. That's largely self-explanatory. And the natural culmination and amalgamation of those two games, once known as shoes in a tree. He observes very thought-out, intellectual-style games. Izzy Swear, also at Skate Raleigh today, has known some of her graveside friends for more than a decade, from when they all lived close on Brent Road and then Lundy Drive and hung out together. Swear would take her dog to Graveside where the dog could roam around off-leash. She met her boyfriend at Graveside DIY. I loved every minute out there, she says. It was cool, because we didn't have to, like, text each other to hang out. I just knew everyone was going to be there. Places like that are rare these days, I say, and Swear agrees. There are other places like that that I've experienced. They're like bars. It's a place you can actually, like, do an activity and hang out a little. The crew had caught wind of this upcoming development about 2 years ago and followed the developer's proposed plan for the property on its journey through the city's bureaucratic machinery. Swear says, I'm surprised it took as long because it's such a good location for like any development. Noting the spot is 2 minutes from I-40, 10 minutes from downtown, 5 minutes from NC State. But we were there for a long time and it ran its course perfectly. In mid-December, the skaters threw a farewell party for Graveside. They built a stage and the band played. Then they destroyed the stage and the musicians destroyed their instruments. J. Rob says, people came from like all over the place to go to the final party. It's like everyone's together and having a really fun time. The party marked the end of an era. On December 31st, the sale closed. Blue Heel paid 6 times more than what the association had paid for the same parcel a decade ago. The transaction was years in the making. In the summer of 23, Blue Heel submitted an application to the city to subdivide the site and annex it into Raleigh. The City Board of Adjustments meeting in 24. The developer requested variances from the unified ordinance. Neighbors raised concerns about flooding, water quality, and the potential for the townhome's sewer system to fail. The developer's lawyer outlined a plan to provide paved street access to the old family cemetery for people who visit the graveyard. In sworn testimony before this quasi-judicial governing body, Elijah Cameron, one of the Graveside skaters, pleaded the case for the skate park. Quote, the park holds immense value, serving as more just a recreational spot. It stands as a testament to our community's resilience and unity. It's also the largest community park of its kind in North Carolina and represents our shared aspirations and dreams, a big community where diverse identities converge for a common purpose. Oh, the article goes down and continues all the remaining obstacles, so there were none. The council voted 7-1 to approve the annexation, and the bulldozers rolled up 2 months later. So, with the Graveside now destroyed, several skaters are taking their quest to find a new spot to the city council chambers during evening public comment sessions. As they've asked the city leaders to help them identify new permanent space they could use, potentially at J.C. Park, Dix Park, or the upcoming Smoky Hollow Park, they've spoken about the inclusiveness of the local skating community and the lessons that come from building a community space. I'm going to conclude this article. It goes on for 2 or 3 more pages, and I better get to other items. So, in short, they haven't got a single venue yet to produce such a large undertaking as what had to come down, and I'm sure the Indie Week will be on the spot to record it as, if it happens. Another article from Durham now, about Durham's HERT program, which is seeking funding boost so that it can operate 24/7. What started as a pilot program in Durham 3 years ago has grown into the heartbeat of the city's public safety network. HERT stands for Holistic Empathetic Assistance Response Team. That was launched as a pilot in 22 under the Community Safety Department and has since responded to more than 28,000 calls. The original team operated with 20 employees during standard work hours, but after an expansion the following year, the program more than doubled to 50-plus employees across four units: Community Response, Co-Response, Crisis Diversion and Care Navigation, and covered all of Durham. Now, with budget season underway, advocates are pushing for city leadership to once again bolster HART's resources to allow the team to operate around the clock and serve more residents in need during operating hours. This year, Community Safety has requested a $4 million funding increase to hire 44 additional full-time employees, which would expand the operating hours for these crisis response teams to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and provide some overnight coverage for a crisis call diversion. The increased funding would also allow the crisis response team to get a majority of, quote, eligible calls that flow to HART from the 911 dispatcher. Currently, HART teams are only able to respond now to 50 to 55% of eligible calls, says Ryan Smith, who directs the Community Safety Department. Last year, the team missed 20,000. The co-response team, which currently operates from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., and pairs a mental health professional with a police officer, is able to respond to 12% of eligible calls. Crisis call diversion, that's a small unit of mental health professionals in the 911 call center who support residents experiencing mental health crises, are now able to respond to about 75% of their eligible calls. The next frontier, and the reason many advocates want to increase funding for HART, is overnight service. From midnight to 6 a.m., no HART team is available to any resident. The 911 call center responds to roughly 1,500 different call natures, from trespassing to heart attacks and shootings. Dispatchers use a series of pre-coded questions to navigate the caller and the public safety staff through the most appropriate response. Calls involving mental health crises, trespassing, welfare checks, intoxicated individuals, and other categories may receive a response from HART only, or both HART and Durham Police, depending on the situation. While out on patrol, HART team members can also self-initiate a wellness check, or what Smith often refers to as a heart assist. If they see a person in need, they might pass out a water bottle on a hot day, or the occasional tent for those seeking shelter. But Smith says those detours don't take available teams away from their top priority, which is still responding to calls. Even if the City Council awarded Community Safety with the additional resources requested, the department would still need time to hire staff and ramp up services. And says, even if they gave us every resource to get to every single call next year, it won't happen next year. At its core, HART remains a response team, but their daily interaction with some of Durham's most vulnerable residents have stretched their reach into other areas. For years, the city has contracted with Housing for New Hope, a Durham-supportive housing nonprofit, to conduct street outreach with Durham's homeless population. The group spearheads the city's Point in Time count, P-I-T count, each year. In recent years, HART has deployed team members to support the PIT program, but at a Homelessness Service Advisory Council meeting in March, Housing for New Hope Executive Director Russell Pierce suggested that HART take on the city's street outreach efforts. It's not something we can't do, it's not something we don't want to do, he said, but sometimes, as an organization, You have to reflect on what the greatest needs are and where you can make the greatest contribution. We realized that supportive housing is the place where we can have the greatest impact. Street outreach is a natural evolution for the HEART team. They employ a variety of highly skilled clinicians and healthcare professionals and regularly come in contact with neighbors in need of housing. But that has not come without growing pains. Pierce and Smith agree that some outreach efforts have become duplicative as HEART has stepped into new territory. As part of the shift away from housing for new hope, Pierce says the HEART team will need to do a better job of tracking its interactions with unhoused residents so that nonprofits like Housing for New Hope can remain informed on what services folks are already receiving. Smith says, if it's not going to be Housing for New Hope, I think we are well situated to do that work. Community safety already has its hands full responding to calls. Even if they are equipped to perform street outreach, the department would need more staff and other resources beyond even the requested budget increase to fulfill this new role. Smith says that isn't work we can just easily pick up and do with the resources we have because of the way our capacity is stretched. But is that something we could do and do well? Yeah, I think so. And I think it would make sense, given how we're positioned and given the hours that we cover. Even without an influx of new funding, reinforcements could be on the horizon. On April 17th, Durham City Manager Bo Ferguson announced forthcoming changes to the city's organizational chart. Starting this July, the homelessness service team, which is currently housed under community development, will move under Smith's Community Safety Department. As community safety has grown, there's been a focus on what I call stabilization, meeting people in crisis and trying to get them on a path towards stability. The HEART team has really developed some skill sets, mental health connection, crisis intervention, and those skills and understanding felt very similar to the work we've been growing in homelessness response. Well, folks, here come our musicians telling me I better stop this article. I'm sorry I can't finish it for you. IndieWeek.com online provides the entire contents of Indie Week and many other articles I never get a chance to read for you online, and it is free. And I suggest that you check that out if you have resources to do that. In the meantime, this particular show will be put in our podcast section as of Friday, and it will remain in the collection for, oh, I don't know, decades maybe, based on the files. So you can always listen to it again if my voice is particularly satisfying to you. Otherwise, my voice, John Fetterson's voice, is going to now bid you farewell from the North Carolina Reading Service. Thanks. Bye-bye.